So as I say, we're returning to the book of Exodus this morning, and we're just looking at a very short passage, chapter 20, verses 1 to 3. There was an article in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago about the 2024 Olympics in Paris and the plans afoot for its opening ceremony. This is what the article said. Organisers of the Paris 2024 Olympics have unveiled a spectacular and audacious plan for the biggest opening ceremony in history. With a 6-kilometre parade of athletes in boats along the River Seine, watched by more than 600,000 people, the athletes, who will be in more than 160 boats, will pass by Paris's most iconic monuments, bridges, and cultural institutions, including Notre Dame, the Louvre, and the Eiffel Tower. The president of the Paris 2024 organizing committee told The Guardian it will be the most audacious and accessible opening ceremony in the Games' history. That's what hosting the Olympics is all about these days, isn't it? Putting on a bigger and better opening ceremony than what has gone before. The organizers don't think, let's make sure that the running track and the tennis courts and the beach volleyball arena are of the best possible quality. They think, right, London's opening ceremony involved the Queen parachuting into the stadium, and Tokyo's opening ceremony involved 1,800 drones forming a giant globe in the sky. How can our opening ceremony go further? How can it be more dramatic? How can it top all of that? Now, as we return to the book of Exodus this morning, the Israelites are at Mount Sinai. And so far in chapter 19, some pretty dramatic things have taken place there. I mean, forget parachuting monarchs and flawlessly coordinated drones. They pale into insignificance alongside the thunder, lightning, thick cloud, fire, smoke, trumpet blast, and trembling mountain that have occurred here. And as we move into chapter 20 then, and the Sinai event continues, we perhaps find ourselves asking that question which haunts the organisers of Olympic Games opening ceremonies. How can what has gone before be topped? Surely God has already pulled out all the stops here. He's already maxed out with all those multi-sensory phenomena. How can he surpass the stuff of chapter 19? Well, this is how. Chapter 20, verse 1. And God spoke. And God spoke. John L. Mackay, in his commentary, writes this. The theophany, a theophany, as you know, is a manifestation of God. The theophany that has been described in chapter 19 was not the ultimate revelation that God gave of himself to the Israelites. It clearly revealed his power, majesty, and holiness. But God had not come just to overawe the people with his splendor, but to communicate to them. In other words, as God now in chapter 20 articulates things, as he engages in verbal communication, the peals of thunder and flashes of lightning and billows of smoke and everything else that has transpired so far are eclipsed. They are put into the shade. And I want to pause there. Do you realize this? Do you realize that when God speaks, when he states what he has done for his people and he stipulates how he wants them to live, which are essentially the two components of his speaking in our passage this morning, when he does that, it surpasses, it's bigger and better than any amount of spectacular, sensational, cosmic phenomena. Do you realize that? It isn't some remote, abstract, irrelevant question that I'm asking you here. It's a very pertinent question for this reason. God is speaking now. I mean, right now. This is a sermon. What is a sermon? A preacher sharing a few thoughts that he has had? No, God speaking. God stating what he has done for his people and stipulating how he wants them to live. That's what a sermon is. That's what we are exposing ourselves to as we gather here Sunday after Sunday. That is what is happening right now. God speaking. And so, as I say, it's a pertinent question. Do you realize that when God speaks, it trumps every kind of sight, every kind of sound, every kind of drama, however mesmerizing, however transfixing, however evocative, God speaking trumps them all? I mean, if our service this morning involves some of the things featured in Exodus 19, a few of the audio-visual eruptions that we have there, we'd pay attention all right, wouldn't we? Our minds wouldn't be drifting off to next week's groceries list or to last night's match of the day. Well, our service doesn't involve any of that. But what it does involve is God speaking. And that's superior. The thing which at Sinai was climactic, I'm saying, and for which deafening thunder and blinding lightning and suffocating smoke clouds were only the warm-up act, that thing we have in our service this morning. We have God speaking. Let's take that seriously. Well, as we begin to look at God speaking here at Sinai then, I want us to do so in terms of those two components that I mentioned just now. I want us to consider what God states, and I want us to consider what God stipulates. First of all then, what God states. What God states. Verse 2. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Don't be fooled by the ordinariness of that verb brought out. I mean, it's what you do when you get home after a trip to the supermarket, isn't it? You open the boot of your car and bring out all the shopping that's in there. And in the Hebrew Old Testament, it can be used like that. I don't mean it's ever used of bringing out shopping from a car boot, but it is used in connection with similarly banal situations sometimes. Here, however, when God says, I brought you out of the land of Egypt, he means this. He means, I heard from my heavenly throne your cries of pain and misery as you languished under Pharaoh's bondage. I found for you a leader to unite you and organize you and do heroic things on your behalf. I battered your oppressors with devastating plague after devastating plague. I spared your firstborn on the night of my wrath when your homes deserved it just as much as anybody else's did. I moved the hearts of the Egyptians to lavish riches on you as you exited their land. I accompanied you in a protective cloud as your journey from Egypt to the promised land began. I provided for you food and drink in an inhospitable wilderness environment. I parted for you the waters of the Red Sea and destroyed for good in those waters your enemy. I gave you victory over the Amalekites when they deemed you vulnerable and traveled from their region in order to waylay you. That's what God means in verse 2. He doesn't have to use a scintillating word here. He can use the humble word brought out. His first audience, after all, have lived through all those events that I've just reeled off to you there. Subsequent audiences have read through those events in chapters 1 to 18. No one's going to mistake the dimensions of the statement God is making there in verse 2. For all its simple language, it's nonetheless an epic statement, a grand statement. He's saying, I saved you. I saved you. That's what the words, I brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, are. They are a resounding statement of salvation. It's not perhaps what you expect to find in Exodus chapter 20. It's like the famous Christmas truce in 1914. And on those battlefields between the opposition trenches, you expect to find blood, and you expect to find corpses, and you expect to find severed body parts, and you expect to find the debris of used ammunition. You don't expect to find there a friendly game of football going on between British and German soldiers. And yet, for a short window at least, that's what you get on World War I's front line. And in Exodus 20, you expect everything to be about obedience. You don't expect a statement of salvation there. Perhaps, indeed, some of you didn't even realize there was one here. You thought that the passage just went straight from, and God spoke all these words saying, to, you shall have no other gods before me. You certainly wouldn't know from the ESV heading, would you, that verse 2 exists. The Ten Commandments, the ESV proclaims this passage to be. That's what it's about. Commandments demanding obedience. But I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. That's not remotely commandment-like. It's as far from being a commandment as you can get. It's unambiguously, unapologetically a statement of salvation. And there it is then, standing imposingly at the doorway of all this material on obedience. What's the significance of that? What does it tell us? Well, at least three things. First, it means obedience doesn't secure salvation. Hear me when I say that. It means obedience doesn't secure salvation. I mean, that should be obvious anyway from how things have unfolded in the book of Exodus. At no point when the Israelites were in Egypt did God give them a set of commands to obey in order to merit being rescued. Moses didn't stagger back from the burning bush encounter with God, lugging tablets of stone, laying out the moral preconditions for the Exodus. No, God just came along and saved them. When law and commandments and obedience still weren't even in their vocabulary. So I'm saying it should be obvious anyway that obedience doesn't secure salvation. But now the arrangement of chapter 20 here confirms it and makes it unmistakable. For as God sets out here the obedience that he desires, he describes at the very outset there in verse 2 the people from whom he desires it. Namely, people who are saved. Not people trying to be saved, not people who will be saved if they successfully accomplish this obedience. No, this obedience is for people who are saved. Verse 2 doesn't come at the end of the passage as a tentative possibility resulting from the obedience. It comes at the beginning of the passage as a definite, absolute backdrop to and context for the obedience. The obedience doesn't secure salvation. It's practiced by men and women and boys and girls whose salvation is secure. The security of their salvation unrelated to their obedience. And in our New Testament context, things work in exactly the same way. Obedience doesn't secure salvation. It's tempting when talking about this to use that phrase, it goes without saying. But it doesn't go without saying. Many, many people think that heaven is gained by being good. They might not actually use the word obedience and the language of obedience securing salvation, but it's the same thing. Heaven is gained by being good. If such a thought is lurking somewhere in you this morning, I plead with you, face up to its absurdity. Recognize how incapable you are of being good enough, of obeying God well enough to win admission to heaven. Abandon such ideas. Forget being good. Forget obedience. Go instead to God and ask for salvation as a pure gift. Pin your hopes on the mercy and grace of God, not on anything you have done, are doing, or intend to do in the future. I'm saying this statement of salvation at the threshold of the passage, it means obedience doesn't secure salvation. Secondly, though, it means obedience doesn't undermine salvation. It means obedience doesn't undermine salvation. You know how you get these self-contradictory notices in the local papers sometimes, the sort that end up being read out on Radio 4 comedy programmes. Gosforth Vegetarian Society monthly social event, meet at 7 p.m. at the steakhouse on the high street. That kind of thing. And it might seem as though we have something like that here. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, and then all this stuff that you have to obey. It's like a vegetarian society having their social event at a steakhouse. A people freed from slavery, now having to live lives of obedience of all things. Or at least that's what it seems like if we adopt the idea that having to obey diminishes one's freedom. I suspect that's a common idea amongst modern Western people, and I suspect it's a common idea amongst modern Western Christians. They're clear on this idea that we've just talked about, obedience doesn't secure salvation, that it should be abandoned when it comes to obtaining salvation. But that then spills over into this further idea that it should continue to be abandoned once salvation has been secured by the grace and mercy of God. But that second idea must be challenged. I remember hearing a story about the 20th century New Testament scholar Leon Morris, and he was doing some lecturing in a seminary, and he was walking down the corridor between lectures, and a student stopped him and said, Professor Morris, please would you tell me your interpretation of this particular passage in John's Gospel. And so he stopped and he talked with this student for several minutes and told him what he thought was the right interpretation of this passage in John. And once he had finished, the student said to him, well, that's very interesting, Professor Morris. Why then do you give a different interpretation in your commentary on John's Gospel? And the nice thing about the story is that Leon Morris himself went around telling it afterwards, because he was a humble man. But we can contradict ourselves, can't we? And if you've written a commentary many years ago, then perhaps when you're in conversation all that time later, you might say something that clashes with what you'd written in the commentary. But it's unlikely that Leon Morris or anyone else within the commentary itself is going to strikingly contradict himself, or within a single lecture is going to strikingly contradict himself. When there's a gap of years, when there's distance between, then possibly you get that kind of inconsistency and contradiction, but not within a single page of a book, not within a single lecture. Well, in this case then, it isn't God in one part of the Bible talking about how he has saved his people by his own work and his own mercy and grace, and then in another part of the Bible talking about how his people have to obey him. And we might think, well, you know, there's a big distance there, and so perhaps that's why some kind of mistake and inconsistency has slipped in. No, we're talking about, in the very same breath, God saying, on the one hand, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of slavery, and in the very next breath, saying, obey. Obey this, and this, and this, and this. Because clearly then, saved, liberated people can be serious about obedience. And that doesn't undermine salvation. It isn't questionable and dubious for saved, liberated people to be serious about obedience. It doesn't threaten to take the gloss off the wonder of God's saving grace. And don't listen then to those in the Church of Jesus Christ who might give you that impression. Be clear. Saved people can healthily and wholesomely be serious about obedience. Obedience doesn't undermine salvation. But I want to take that a step further. I mention one further implication from the way that salvation and obedience are juxtaposed here in our passage. Thirdly, it means obedience doesn't accompany salvation. It means obedience doesn't accompany salvation. Now, that might sound surprising. I guess that probably is how many of us think. We think like this, that we have our salvation over here. This wonderful salvation from the guilt and from the penalty of sin. Salvation from eternal damnation. We have salvation over here. And as those then who have experienced that salvation, we accompany it with obedience over here. And we have no problem with that as Reformed Evangelical Christians. We don't see the latter as undermining the former. But nonetheless, we see these two things as separate, compatible, yes, but separate entities, separate realities, salvation and our accompanying obedience. But it seems to me that in the last analysis, this sharp juxtaposition that we have here in our passage, the way that God moves from this statement of salvation to all this material on his people's obedience, it seems to me that in the last analysis, the most natural way to read it would be to put a colon at the end of verse 2. The Hebrew doesn't have punctuation. But to put a colon at the end of verse 2. So he says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, colon, you shall have no other gods before me, and so on. In other words, this now is what that salvation that I've just stated actually looks like. This is the form it takes, you living like this. In other words, that's not the accompaniment to salvation, it is salvation. It's salvation in action, living like this, living according to these commandments that are going to ensue in the rest of this chapter. Living like that actually is giving expression to salvation. It's the stuff of salvation. It's salvation in action. Because you see, this is the thing. And I think I said this the other day in a different connection. Salvation isn't just from the guilt and penalty of sin. I don't think I would even say salvation is primarily from the guilt and penalty of sin. Salvation is from sin. And that covers a whole range of sin's pernicious aspects. And we equally say from them all, yes, the guilt of sin, so that we're right with God this morning. Yes, the penalty of sin, so there's no condemnation awaiting us in eternity. But also, and just as much, from the power and the rule and the grip and the control of sin in our lives. That's just as wonderful a part of salvation as any other. So that being able to live like Exodus 20, that's not just the kind of the small print that accompanies salvation. That is salvation. It's wonderful to be able to live like that. We couldn't without salvation. It's only salvation that turns us into these kinds of people. Two New Testament texts bring this out, I think. One is Philippians chapter 2. More than two texts do, but two do explicitly using the actual language of salvation. So Philippians chapter 2, and we know the first part of that chapter and the hymn about Christ. But then Paul goes on in verse 12, therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. He's talking here to these believers who are arguing and are jostling for position in the church. That's why he's shown them Christ, who is the ultimate example of a somebody who became a nobody voluntarily. And he's saying, I want you to do the same. And here in verse 12, he describes that as working out or giving expression to your salvation. This is what you've been saved to live like. When you live like Christ, putting others' interests before your own, that is a powerful expression of salvation in action. The unsaved person can't do that. The unsaved person is bound to argue and bicker and put himself or herself first. The other text is even more explicit, and it's Titus chapter 3. And in Titus chapter 3, then, Paul begins by telling Titus, remind them, that's the people you're pastoring, remind them to be submissive to rulers and authorities, to be obedient, to be ready for every good work, to speak evil of no one, avoid quarreling, be gentle, show perfect courtesy towards all people. So he's commanding this very distinctive ethical lifestyle. And then he says in verse 3, that we were once foolish, disobedient, led astray, slaves to various passions, and so on. And the two things don't add up then. Well, if this is what we are by nature, how can we live like verse 1? If we're like verse 2 by nature, how can we live like verse 1? And then Paul explains in verse 4, when the goodness and loving kindness of God our Savior appeared, he saved us. And if we just took that sentence by itself, we would apply it probably to he saved us from the guilt of our sin and from hell. That's not what Paul's talking about. He's saying he saved us from being disobedient, foolish, led astray, slaves to various passions and pleasures, passing our days in malice and envy, hated by others and hating one another. That's what he saved us from. Salvation is just as much from that as it is from guilt and hell. And so living the new lifestyle of verse 1, that doesn't accompany salvation, that is salvation. That is salvation in action. And so, I'm saying then this striking proximity here in Exodus 20. The statement of salvation prefacing all the stuff on obedience. It's important. It's really important. It means that obedience doesn't secure salvation. Obedience is for saved people. But it means obedience doesn't undermine salvation. Otherwise, we have a very self-contradicting God here. But more than that, it means obedience doesn't merely accompany salvation. Obedience is salvation. Glory in this salvation this morning that is more comprehensive than we often talk about it as. This salvation that reaches our natural depravity and undoes that depravity and makes us new people, able to live out the commandments of God. So what God states. But then secondly and more briefly, let's notice what God stipulates. And of course, we're not this morning going to look at everything God stipulates, just the first item, which is there in verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me. And just three things very quickly then as we close. First of all, its meaning. Its meaning. This language then of having no other gods before God. I suppose we tend to think of that language perhaps as being about prioritizing. So we don't have any other gods which we prioritize over God. We use this language in that kind of sense, don't we? We might talk with concern about someone we know. Well, he's putting his work before his family. And so we mean he's prioritizing his work over his family. And that's perhaps how we generally read verse 3 here. But usually in the Bible, usually in the Hebrew Old Testament, the language of before God refers to God's presence. Before God equals in his presence. So you come before God. You come into his presence. That's normally what it means. And I think that's the most natural reading of this verse here. You shall have no other gods in my presence, he's saying. A bit like then you might have a football coach, coaches some lads who play in a team, and he has rules then. And one of his rules is that you're not to have chewing gum. So when you come to training or when you're on the coach going to game, no chewing gum. No chewing gum when you're around me. Of course, you can't ban them from having chewing gum when they're in their homes or when they're out with their mates the rest of the week. But he's saying when you're in my presence, at this football club, no chewing gum. And that's what God is saying here then. No other gods in my presence. But you might say, well, it can't just mean that, Dan. Is this saying then that You know, it's only when we're here on a Sunday, only when we're worshipping, that we're not to have other gods. This surely is a rather weak and a rather lame interpretation of the verse. You shall have no other gods in my presence. Listen to John L. Mackay again. He writes, but how extensive is in my presence? Is this allowing for the existence of heathen gods and merely demanding of Israel that they exclusively worship the Lord? Certainly that was required, but it is unlikely that this commandment was intended to be restricted in such a way. And then he writes this, the court of Yahweh was not merely the sanctuary or the promised land. It embraced the whole world of which he is the creator. And that note, of course, has been struck in the context, hasn't it? Remember back in chapter 19 and verse 5, that verse ends with God saying, all the earth is mine. You know, all the earth is my presence. All the earth is my domain. All the earth is where I am. So that when God says here, you shall have no other gods in my presence, he's not saying there's a place where you can have other gods, because there's no place that isn't God's presence. This is Yahweh, the Most High God, the one and only God of the universe. There's not a nook or a cranny anywhere in this cosmos that isn't God's presence and where suddenly it's okay to have other gods. This is a breathtaking and bold thing that God is saying here. He's saying everywhere that is mine, everywhere where I'm present, everywhere that is my domain, that there are to be no other gods. And that, I'm saying, excludes other gods everywhere. This is a big claim. That's its meaning. But then, secondly, let's move on to its application. Its application. Because I suppose it's easy for us to rush over this commandment, because we say, well, we're in a very different cultural setting from the one that the Israelites were in and the one that God's people were mostly in Bible times and have mostly been in, indeed, throughout subsequent history and in many cases are in today. We're in a different setting. We're not in a polytheistic cultural setting. There aren't lots of temples and shrines to other gods in our streets. Our neighbours mostly don't go to worship sites to bow down to statues and that kind of thing. And so we could read this and say, well, it's not relevant to us. But I'm sure most of you will appreciate that that's not the case. It is relevant to us. It's interesting what Paul writes in Romans chapter 1, where he describes the natural human condition in its and the wrong worship that's so integral to the natural human condition. And this is how he describes it in Romans 1:25. He says that people worship and serve the creature rather than the creator. The problem is not that they worship and serve Molech rather than Yahweh, or Baal rather than Yahweh, or Dagon rather than Yahweh, or Allah rather than Yahweh. No, the problem is that they serve created things, things belonging to the created realm rather than the creator. And yes, worshipping Molech or Dagon or whoever is one expression of that. But that's only one expression of a much wider problem. This is the real problem. In other words, anything, any kind of worship of anything that belongs to the created realm comes under the ban, the prohibition of the first commandment. Not simply bowing down before a religious statue. But then we might say, ah, well, yes, we know that, okay. So we know that gods don't have to take this religious form, and they can take other forms. Gods can be those kind of passions that that grip human beings, those obvious kind of hedonistic passions. And certainly that is the case. Remember Paul's language in Philippians chapter 3 and the way he talks there about people whose God is their belly. And of course he's not there talking about literally bowing down in worship before your stomach. He's talking about sensual passions, in that case food, but probably stands for other similar passions, whether it's for sex or whether it's for drink or whatever it might be. Things that are fine in and of themselves, but when they are used wrongly, when they are abused, become these gods. So certainly those kind of obvious hedonistic passions that they can be gods. But where the New Testament really, I think, hits home and touches raw nerves is when it shows that actually things which are very, very respectable indeed can become gods. I mentioned such a text recently, I think, Luke chapter 14, verse 26, where Jesus says those tremendously striking words, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." Jesus is saying there that these very respectful, very proper, very good, very wholesome things, family members, they can be a god. There, Ralph Davis, in his commentary, writes, "Don't you see it? Luke 14:26 is simply the first commandment, Exodus 20, verse 3, in different language." Actually, while we're talking about the application of this commandment, Deraf Davis makes another very important point from this text in Luke 14. And the striking fact then that this is the first commandment, and yet the person who is being sinned against here is who? It's Jesus. "You cannot be my disciple. If these things are put in front of me," Deraf Davis writes, in my opinion, expositions and commentaries often get us off in the wrong direction when it comes to this verse. They will start saying things like, "Now Jesus doesn't literally mean hate." We run to Matthew 10:37-38 and see what he really meant. We must understand Semitic ways of speaking. Or someone will allude to hyperbole, and so on. Everything is qualified and toned down, and what's worse, off on entirely the wrong track. Maybe it's because many assume verse 26 is about discipleship, and they focus on that. And it is, but not preeminently. Verse 26 is not, first of all, a matter of discipleship, but of Christology. Look at the text. Who gave Jesus the right to talk that way? Who does he think he is? He is saying that he must have the sole and supreme place of affection in your life. What sheer audacity. What is Jesus assuming in what he says here? No one but deity has the right to demand such ultimate loyalty from us. And Jesus does so. Jesus is the God of Exodus 20, verse 3. And applying it then in our context means asking ourselves the question, are there things, perhaps very good and very proper things, which I love more than I love Jesus? Which, if it came to it, if push came to shove, I would hold on to and dispense with Jesus rather than holding on to Jesus and dispensing with them? It's a searching question, isn't it? But that's the application then of this to us. So it's meaning, it's application, but then one other thing, it's tone. It's tone. And I suppose we read verse 3 and we think, well, it sounds quite austere, doesn't it? Sounds quite stern. "You shall have no other gods in my presence." Until you start to think, what echo of this kind of language do we have in our own culture? Where would we go in our own culture to find some point of contact, some slight equivalent? Would it not be a wedding service? And those three powerful words that are usually spoken in a wedding service, forsaking all others. Do you commit yourself to this woman? Do you commit yourself to this man? Forsaking all others. That's what God is requiring of his people here, isn't it? Forsaking all others. And that's a telling analogy then. Because it shows that what we have here in the last analysis is not something stern and prohibitive and restrictive. What we have here is a lover. A lover who is saying, I love you so much that like any bridegroom standing at the front of a church building, I want you to commit yourself to me, forsaking all others. No loving spouse shrugs their shoulders at the idea of a husband or wife playing around with other lovers? No, every spouse wants their husband or wife to forsake all others. And that's a beautiful thing. It shows the intensity of their love, the intensity of their passion for that person. And this, I'm saying, shows the intensity of God's passion for us. That he's not a relaxed, laid-back, casual God who doesn't really care how many other affections and allegiances we have in our lives. No, he's a God that wants our hearts because he's a jealous lover of a God. Don't you want a God like that? Don't you want a God who loves you enough to utter the words of the first commandment? A God who, despite running the universe, still wants your undivided relationship, your undivided affection. What a God this is. Not some boring, impersonal deity who just keeps the planets in their orbit. This is a lover God, a passionate God, a jealous God, a marital God, a bridegroom God. And so, believer, forsake all others. Keep yourself for him. And if you're not a believer, you won't find anywhere else a God as beautiful as this. A God of jealous, passionate, intense love. Come to him this morning and make him your king and your God. Amen.